Ronald Reagan did in 1980 or FDR did in 1932. These are these two great realignment presidents. Great, not in the sense that I support Reagan, but, you know, powerful. And what they did was articulate a really profound, completely countervailing set of ideas and institutions, and were able to shatter the existing dispensation. I think that's the question that's on the table and that Bernie is sort of slowly pushing towards.
Well, Corey Robin, we thank you for this very interesting discussion, one we will continue. Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and Graduate Center of City University of New York, author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. A very happy birthday to a landmark birthday to Anna Osbeck. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film The Real Dirt on Farmer John on Thursday, April 12th at 7 p.m. The Real Dirt on Farmer John is a documentary about a maverick Midwestern farmer amidst a failing economy and heralds a resurrection of farming in America. Filmmaker Taggart Siegel will be in attendance, and there will be a Q&A after the film. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Eco Film Festival's Earth Day weekend celebration from April 20th through the 22nd at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival features films about the environment, nature conservation, outdoor adventure, agriculture, and community wellness. This Earth Day weekend celebration is four screenings over 3 days featuring the films The Reluctant Radical, Beyond the Big Fish, and more. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival's Earth Day weekend celebration from April 20th through the 22nd at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, yesterday's Beds Not Bullets rally at City Hall called for city employee and police auditing.
Wheeler implies Russia is behind the malcontent of social media followers.
And in international news, New Zealand bans offshore drilling.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 12th, 2018. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Around 100 people gathered outside Portland City Hall Wednesday afternoon to protest the latest police killing in the city. The fatal shooting took place this past Saturday evening at City Team Ministries in southeast Portland, where police cornered John Elifritz, who was suffering from a mental health crisis. Here are some of the speakers from yesterday's protest.
And every single choice that led up to the events of the night of April 7th were bad choices. Every one of them. This is a management problem. When I go into a restaurant and the restaurant's filthy and my burger wasn't the way I wanted it and they gave me some nasty ass fries, do I look at the dude behind the counter? No, I'm looking at management. And that's where this ends. Now, I want to point out that the city is in violation of their consent decree with the DOJ as relates to the way they treat their mentally ill. They are non-compliant. I don't see it getting better. I don't want another agreement. That's just my personal belief. They've got no business running around like cowboys on the street. It's not the wild, wild west. This is Portland, Oregon, and we don't roll like that.
Why does it keep happening over and over and over again? Yes, we have individual policemen who are bad, like Darrell Shaw, who just got an article written about them, who shot someone, who beat someone, has numerous complaints against them. Four of the police officers involved in this shooting, in the past, multiple complaints against them. One of them was involved in another shooting. This just keeps happening over and over again. The man who executed Quanice Hayes had also executed another person who was suffering from a mental crisis. Why does this keep happening over and over again? Well, maybe it's because they keep these officers who are problem officers. Why are they still on the force? When someone is a danger to the community, why do you keep sending them out into the community? It's a pretty easy problem to solve. And with all the problems here in Portland, the housing crisis that's happening, the problem with racism in the police department, all of these things, something that seems pretty easy is to pull out the broken gear.
Those were voices of people participating in a protest against violence at Portland City Hall yesterday afternoon. In the first 3.5 months of 2018, 5 people have been killed by police in the state of Oregon. John Elifritz was the latest. Elifritz's case immediately came into further controversy when the alt-weekly paper Willamette Week reprinted parts of a Portland Monthly 2007 story featuring John Elifritz talking about his membership in the white supremacist prison gang, European Knights, through his alleged childhood friend, European Knight founder David Kennedy. Elifritz's family has not been able to be reached for comment, but have said in public statements that John Elifritz was a loving father to his 2 young daughters who had recently had issues with substance abuse and mental health.
Portland Resistance's rally outside City Hall to increase the awareness of police violence in response to the death of John Elifritz at the hands of police gunfire last Saturday reminded those gathered that approximately 53 unarmed people of color have been killed by the police since Donald Trump was elected president. Elifritz was not of color, but Portland resistance organizers emphasized the data pointing to Portland police's history with violent solutions to people with mental health challenges and the criminalization of people of color, citing the DOI settlement. Another goal of the rally was to collect resources for the houseless community. Such monetary donations, jackets, blankets, tents, menstrual supplies, and additional toiletries. Several other organizations and social justice speakers were present at the event. Activist Greg McElvey was the first speaker to open the rally.
All of this is about community and community building, and that's why at every protest we hope that people come away knowing somebody new, because these are the people that are willing to fight for the same things that you're willing to fight for and care about the same things as you, and when stuff goes down, they're the ones that are going to have your back. So today we are obviously gathered here today for multiple reasons, one of which the sort of catalyst of what happened here is the shooting of John Elifritz. I hope I'm saying the last name correctly. And we all saw the video, and I think that everybody can tell that from watching the video that something here is not right, right? We live in a country where police are continuously shooting people. We live in a city where police are continuously shooting people. Just in recent memory, we have Quanice Hayes, Terrell Johnson, and many more people that are on the list right here. This is not normal. There's countries across the world who are not shooting people at the rate that just the city of Portland is, right? And so when a lot of people come up with excuses, they say, well, oh, crimes were committed, or oh, he had a knife, or he had some problematic affiliations in the past or something like that. None of that is a reason for somebody to be executed in the streets. And I don't think that Americans as people are any worse than the people in countries where the police are not gunning people down. countries across Europe, countries across the world, where police are not shooting people at these same troubling rates. It's not okay for police to decide to execute people in the streets, ever. Doesn't matter who the person was. It doesn't matter what their affiliations were. It doesn't matter what they were going through in that day. Police should not be executing people in the streets. And we all saw that video and saw that this person was outgunned, outmanned. There were 8 officers apparently that fired, and there's no reason that they should be that scared for their lives with somebody with a knife, right? If you're a police officer and you walk around our streets scared all the time and trigger happy, then maybe you shouldn't be a police officer. At what point did we decide that policing is supposed to be a job with no risk, right? We see these people that say Blue Lives Matter, but policing isn't even in the top 5 dangerous jobs in the country. Where's Fishermen Lives Matter, right? A much more dangerous job than policing. But yet we don't see Fishermen Lives Matter, but yet we continuously see Blue Lives Matter. I'm not saying that policing isn't a dangerous job. I'm saying that when you sign up to be a police officer, there is some inherent risk. And you shouldn't be willing to shoot somebody over them having a knife, them being a criminal, or being accused of committing a crime at that moment. It doesn't matter who you are. That said, we have a mayor here who thinks that we need more police officers in this city. Specifically, we need 93 new police officers. I don't know why that's the magic number, but that's the magic number. It doesn't make sense, because we just saw in that video what police officers' solutions to different situations is. It's guns out, guns drawn, bullets flying, right? But that's not the solution that our community needs. We need more assistance. We need more services. We need to end the housing crisis that we are going through right now. We need more mental health services. We need more addiction services. We need support, not bullets, right? So there's going to be, so our mayor is going to keep trying to push for and get you, the people of Portland, to lobby for more police officers. And we're here to say that no, actually the people of Portland and us here today are gonna do the exact opposite of that. So going around are some flyers that have city council members' numbers and emails on it. I want everybody that's here today, you don't have to get the flyer, but you at least need to be, I mean, it's 2018, most of us can Google what their numbers are, but you do need to actually do the call. And I know that most of us, I don't call anybody. It's only text. If somebody calls me, I'm like, what the hell is going on? But we need to make these calls, right? This is important. You need to send these emails. Because what the people that are still calling and using the phones are the exact same people that are asking for more police officers. So we need to combat that and use their tactic of calling our city council members and say, no, we don't need more money for the police. What we actually need is more services. And to do that, we're going to be, hopefully, more and more people will be coming to the budget hearings where Ted Wheeler is expecting and calling for more people to come out and ask for more officers to come out and do the exact opposite. And so it's very important that everybody that's here today also makes these calls, also sends these emails, and also comes to the budget hearing, which I think we all should, because it's gonna be far less wet and there's gonna be chairs and more comfortable. And also another factor of this is the police union contract that you might have all remembered, that many people got beat up out of the same building fighting against the police union contract that we just signed. And that's going to be up for negotiation again very soon here. And we need to start talking about it now. There's some things in there that are common sense that we should be removing and that other cities have done, such as Austin, Texas, where the city council unanimously voted against their new police union contract. So we need to start organizing against that now, because last time many people, street activists, were sort of late to the party on that. And it resulted in us getting beat up on these same steps. We're not gonna make that same mistake this time. We're gonna start organizing against that new contract and for a fair contract now.
Activist and former NAACP president and current candidate for Portland City Council, Joanne Hardesty, was also one of the speakers present at the Beds Not Bullets rally. She delivered a passionate speech insisting that thorough audits be conducted of each position within the Portland Police Bureau. Here's more.
Like you, my heart broke when I saw that video. There is no reasonable explanation how a dozen quote-unquote well-trained professional police officers who have all been trained in mental health crisis intervention would have made the decisions that they made on Saturday. When I hear that they had no choice, I ask you to consider that many, many, many bad decisions were made on Saturday.
That's right.
Many by Portland police officers at the scene. I understand there was a Multnomah County sheriff in it for some reason. And this is on top of the auditor's report on the gang enforcement unit that has 28 officers who don't take calls, don't assist in emergency activities. Their only job is to ride around the city of Portland looking for gang members. Now, there's a problem in Portland Police Bureau, and the problem is one of accountability. Not only is there no criteria for what a gang member is, there's no criteria for making stops. In a city with a 6% African American population total, 90% of the traffic stops were of African Americans.
Unacceptable.
Totally unacceptable. The problem is, we normally, the only information we get about what is happening inside Portland Police Bureau comes from Portland Police Bureau. The two times since I've lived in Portland where we've had an independent, no skin in the game evaluation was when the Department of Justice came in 2012, and now just recently with the auditor's report on the gang enforcement unit. Now, when the DOJ came, they found Portland police guilty of using excessive force against people with mental health issues and people with perceived mental health issues.
That's right.
Now, what was the DOJ's solution? They put Portland police in charge of being first responders. I don't know about you, but that was the stupidest idea I'd ever heard. How about firefighters? How do you feel when you see a firefighter running towards you? You feel like help is on its way because they are trained to help. They are not trained to kill community members that don't do what they're told. I have been asking, why is no one intellectually curious as to why so many African Americans are labeled gang members? In a city that prides itself on what? Being a sanctuary city? A city that is supposedly welcoming and inclusive? You can't have 50 years of progressive leadership and get the outcomes that we get. It is time for change. It is time for real leadership. And it is time for you to demand the kind of community police force that you want. We do not want a militarized police force that is scared of the community that they serve. Police will not solve our housing problem. Police will not solve the lack of mental health services. Police will not solve the fact that so many families in our community are insecure. I want police to go back to the basics. Anything that isn't about solving crime and preventing crime, I want them to stop doing.
We need an audit of every position inside Portland Police Bureau, because if the supervisors aren't supervising, why are they supervisors?
Mayor Ted Wheeler wrote last Tuesday to the Department of Justice requesting an investigation into suspicious activity on Portland social media accounts, including his own. In his letter, he asked the investigation to look at fake accounts that appear to, in his words, sow discord in local politics in America, including in the city of Portland. The letter cites fake followers of his official Twitter and Facebook accounts who are active on hot-button political topics. The Portland Tribune published this excerpt, quote, "Based on the nature of some posts to city social media accounts and Russian propaganda accounts made publicly available, I believe it may be likely that Portland Twitter and Facebook accounts may have been or currently are being used by foreign conspirators in an attempt to sow political discord in our local politics in Portland," end quote. The letter was addressed to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and Lauren Cannon, the special agent in charge of the Portland FBI office. Michael Cox, Wheeler's spokesperson, said the fake followers and suspicious activity were first noticed by a social media manager hired by the mayor's office last year. Cox went on to say that activity spiked during contentious events such as the planning for the Patriot Prayer Rally after the fatal attack on a man on a MAX train by white supremacist Jeremy Christian. Mayor Wheeler and Portland police came under fire for their lack of safety policies during the Patriot Prayer Rally, which resulted in a lawsuit filed by the ACLU towards Wheeler and PPB for detaining hundreds of citizens and journalists, taking their photos, and recording their personal information. That case was filed November 15th. The case is still in the courts. KBOO News was on the scene at the Patriot Rally June 4th with other local and national news outlets that witnessed those accusations. Police were also found using homemade munitions and working complicitly with militia members. Cox says Rosenstein and Cannon did not immediately respond to the letter. Wheeler has posted the letter on his city website.
Missouri Governor Eric Greitens is refusing to step down after a special bipartisan investigative committee deemed a woman accusing him of sexual assault to be credible. The woman, who had had an affair with Greitens before he became governor, said that she felt compelled to perform oral sex on Greitens in order to leave his house safely. This happened after having been assaulted and then photographed in a compromising manner against her will. The governor is due to go on trial for felony charge of invasion of privacy for the photo that he took of the woman that night. She is also claiming that he used that photo to blackmail her into never talking about her her ordeal publicly. Several of the woman's friends and ex-husband corroborated this story. Greitens became the Republican governor in 2016 and billed himself as an outsider with family values while he was running for office. He has called this investigation a, quote, witch hunt.
As reported by The New Yorker, a doorman at Trump Tower was paid a significant amount by the media company that runs the National Enquirer. Although The New Yorker found no evidence that there ever was a child fathered by Donald Trump in the late 80s as a result of an extramarital affair, it establishes a pattern that the company has been routinely burying stories for the president and shelling out a lot of money. Karen McDougal, a former Playboy model, alleges that the company paid her over $100,000 for her story about her longtime affair with Trump before he became president. Her story was then never printed in a method which some call catch and kill. This comes on the coattails of Trump's lawyer setting up a shell company and then paying $130,000 to Stephanie Clifford, also known as Stormy Daniels, for an affair that Trump denies as ever having taken place.
A union of government and religion tends to destroy government and to degrade religion. That and more in the Civil Liberties Minute.
Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon Thee, and we beg Thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country.
I'm Tom Hartman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
50 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that reciting this prayer daily in all classrooms in public schools violated freedom of religion as guaranteed by the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. The Establishment Clause prevents government from establishing, favoring, or supporting religion, or any particular religion. But it's not an altogether happy anniversary because, in Florida, a new law permits students to deliver inspirational religious messages at compulsory school assemblies. In Tennessee, yet another bill to teach creationism as science. In Arizona, a bill to offer Bible courses that allow clergy to indoctrinate students in public schools. And comparable laws are being proposed, pushed, and passed in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Kansas, Mississippi, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Wyoming as well. Although that 1962 Supreme Court school prayer case, Vitale v. Engel, stands as a bulwark for the separation of church and state, that battle to maintain that wall of separation continues. It is both a necessary and just fight. For as the Supreme Court said a half century ago, the Establishment Clause rests on the belief that a union of government and religion tends to destroy government and to degrade religion.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't defend itself.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Ethos Music Center, launching a website to celebrate 20 years of making music. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be very rainy, with a low of around 44 degrees, followed by, you guessed it, even more rain, and a high around 55 degrees. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it will also be rainy, with a high around 57. Today in history, in 1955, the polio vaccine, developed by Dr. Jonas Salk, is declared safe and effective. Polio has been reduced from an estimated 350,000 cases a year in 1988 to just 1,637 in 2016. The quote of the day is from Herbie Hancock, who was born this day in 1940. Quote, "The value of music is to be able to play one note at the right time in the right way," end quote.
Now we hear from our friends at Climate Connections. In this segment, the risk of heartworm is rising.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Canine heartworm disease is caused by long worms that live in a dog's heart and blood vessels. It can be fatal, and a warming climate could make this disease more common. Heartworm is transmitted by mosquitoes, so it's most common in warm, moist areas such as the southeastern United States. But as the climate changes, other parts of the country may see more mosquitoes, and the mosquito season may get longer.
It could happen because of temperature. It could happen because of changes in rainfall.
Greg Ebel is a professor at Colorado State University. He says temperature also affects mosquitoes' ability to carry heartworm in the first place.
There's a certain number of days that are required for that parasite to develop inside a mosquito. And if there aren't enough days in the summer where the temperature exceeds a certain temperature, then the worm won't develop in the mosquito and it can't be transmitted.
So as the climate warms, more mosquitoes are likely to be carriers, and it's increasingly important to protect your dog. Many vets now recommend giving preventative medication year-round, even in some places where heartworm used to only be a summertime threat. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
KBOO News wants to make a quick correction to its report that the polio has reduced from 350,000 cases a year in 1988. The actual figure would be down to 37 in 2016, not 1,637. Sorry about that. And now we hear from our friends at H2O Radio. It's the week in water. In this week's episode, the EPA Administrator Pruitt has mandated unilateral authority. There are almost as many hogs as people in North Carolina. The third longest river in the lower 48 states has gone dry in places, and ponds encounter urine trouble.
Pruitt grabs control of water regulation as ethics allegations swirl. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
As he was defending himself from a barrage of ethics complaints, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt declared last week that he is now the final authority on Clean Water Act decisions in regulating pollution.
Technically speaking, he made himself the decision maker over what's called geographic jurisdiction, the determination of which bodies of water are protected under the Act.
In the past, decisions about application of the Clean Water Act have been left to field offices of the EPA because deciding what's appropriate depends on local circumstances, according to former EPA career employee Betsy Sutherland, who spoke to Vox.
A spokesperson for the Sierra Club told Inside Climate News that the reason Pruitt has retained control is to allow the agency to hand over a lot of natural resources to polluting interests.
Among the ethical issues Pruitt faces is his use of Safe Drinking Water Act funds to increase the salaries of two people he brought to EPA with him from Oklahoma. The Atlantic reports that the White House had disapproved the pay boosts, but Pruitt went forward anyway in a manner that did not require presidential or congressional approval.
In North Carolina, a trial began last week to determine if hog farms have to pay nearby homeowners for foul-smelling air.
10 families will attempt to prove that pig waste lagoons and the smell of dead hogs plague their properties to the point they can't even sit outside.
There are about 2,100 farms and 9 million pigs, mainly in the southeast part of the Tar Heel State, almost as many animals as people. All the swine waste, unlike that of most humans, goes into open-air pits where the feces and urine stand untreated and break down to some extent.
According to the publication Modern Farmer, the pits leak toxic waste into the environment besides smelling insanely bad. The remnants are liquefied and then sprayed onto nearby crops.
A study from the University of North Carolina linked air pollution from the hog farms to reduced lung function, anxiety, and mucous membrane irritation.
The North Carolina study also found that the hog operations disproportionately affect people of color. The trial is expected to last another 5 weeks.
From the end of October until the middle of March, no rain or snow fell in Beijing, China, its longest drought on record.
Despite the lack of precipitation, people in the city did not undergo any disruptions to their water service. The Economist reports that most of Beijing's drinking water comes from a canal and pipeline system that travels nearly 900 miles.
South to North, as it's called, is the largest diversion in the world from one basin to another, and as the Economist notes, it addresses China's worst environmental threat, not horrible air quality, but lack of water.
Nearly 70% of Beijing's water needs are currently met by the South to North project, but China's needs are growing fast. Other sources are groundwater, which has been overpumped, leading to land subsidence and seawater intrusion.
The project has had effects on rivers in the south. Less water in them is resulting in wetlands drying and contaminants building up.
The increasing dryness, or aridification, of the southwest U.S. has led to an 18-year period of low river and stream flows in parts of the Colorado River Basin. Another basin that is experiencing the lack of water is the Rio Grande.
The Rio Grande is the third largest river in the lower 48, running 1,900 miles. It supplies 6 million people with water and irrigates 2 million acres.
In spring, the Rio Grande usually swells with runoff, but according to New Mexico Political Report, the middle portion of the river has already dried up.
It isn't unusual for the river to run dry for distances up to 90 miles, but this condition happening in April is unprecedented.
Because of the lack of water, biologists have relocated about 15,000 silvery minnows to places where the river is running, and the Bureau of Reclamation is working with other agencies to create a pulse flow.
There's been a lot of focus on plastic pollution in the Earth's oceans recently, but a report out last week in Science Advances shows it's affecting freshwater and land.
Compost collected from homes and grocery stores is a source of microplastic particles less than 5 millimeters in length.
When compost is spread over fields, it contains plastics that can be eaten by worms, gets into waterways, and even becomes airborne.
The greatest amount of microplastics was from grocery store waste. A researcher who was not involved in the study told Science News that it made sense. For instance, a crate of rotting cucumbers wrapped in plastic doesn't just disappear.
And finally, Henry David Thoreau spent 2 years at Walden Pond pondering how to live life simply. During his stay, starting in 1854, he wrote that the water was so transparent, the bottom could easily be seen even 30 feet below the surface.
But oh, how things change. Since then, human activity, from pesticide use, seeping landfills, deforestation, and heavy use by tourists, has altered Walden's ecosystem, according to a new study.
Tourists are taking the biggest toll, say researchers from Paul Smith College. People recreating near the pond are eroding trails and sending sediment into the water. But another thing they deposit into the lake? Urine.
Yes, people are peeing in the water, adding phosphorus to the pond, which is spurring the growth of phytoplankton. Plankton populations have increased significantly since the 1920s, when beach and bathhouse facilities popped up along the pond shores, bringing more swimmers, resulting in murkier, greener waters.
Climate change will exacerbate the situation. Not only will warmer, longer summers likely result in more recreational use, but they'll also create conditions conducive to the growth of plankton.
So what to do, other than encouraging people not to pee in the pond? Perhaps we can quote Thoreau himself, who said, "We can never have enough of nature," and add that in many cases, nature could have a little less of us.
That's it for This Week in Water. We'll see you next time. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
With the May 15th primary around the corner, Governor Kate Brown is earnestly seeking editorial endorsements. She sat down with the Willamette Week to speak to what she agrees with most concerning the Republican national agenda. Brown herself has been adamant in her opposition to Trump's office, but said that she agrees with Trump's Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt. Pruitt, an Oklahoma attorney general, has publicly pandered to the oil and gas industry, aggressively attempting to break down environmental protections like higher vehicle mileage requirements. Brown disagrees with this particular tack and said, "Trump administration incompetence and chaos is causing uncertainty in Oregon." But in terms of a yes, Pruitt is absolutely committed to cleaning up the Portland Harbor as I am. Brown went on to summarize, saying she believes this will bring 50,000 jobs to Portland.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal and political leaders in Washington, D.C. this week said President Trump's proposed 2019 budget sends a powerfully negative message to Indian country. In an oversight hearing for the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs Wednesday, lawmakers heard testimony about Bureau of Indian Affairs programs that face severe cuts or elimination. Aaron Payment is vice president of the National Congress of American Indians. He said Trump's proposed cuts show an unwillingness to uphold the government's trust responsibilities to tribes.
Many of the proposed draconian cuts in the draft budget threaten to limit or abrogate the treaty and trust obligation and is a clear retreat from the federal commitments made to tribes. Tribal parity should always be the driving principle for every federal department or initiative, including addressing the opiate epidemic and the building and repairing of our infrastructure.
Payment said while the NCAI is glad to see some increases for the Indian Health Service, they're alarmed by the proposed elimination of programs including the Indian Community Development Block Grant, low-income energy assistance, and tribal energy loan guarantees. Trump's budget would also do away with the Johnson-O'Malley Act, which subsidizes educational services for Native students, among other things. Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota slammed the Bureau of Indian Affairs, saying it's failed to advocate for enough funds for tribal law enforcement and public safety programs.
Fundamentally, keeping people safe has to be the highest priority. This cannot get ignored. Department of Justice needs to step up. BIA needs to step up if we're going to protect women and children in Indian country. And if we're not willing to step up, then let's just admit that they're second-class citizens. They aren't entitled to the same protection that other people in this country are entitled to.
Robert McGee, vice president of the United South and Eastern Tribes, also expressed concern about Secretary Ryan Zinke's mass reorganization of the Interior Department, which included nearly a dozen employees who are tribal members. The president's budget proposal is just a starting point. Congress will make the final appropriations. The Navajo Nation is the latest tribe to file a lawsuit over opioid addiction. The lawsuit, filed this week in U.S. District Court in New Mexico, points to more than 7,000 overdose deaths on the Navajo Nation from 2014 through 2016. The suit is aimed at prescription drug manufacturers and distributors. In a statement, Navajo President Russell Begay said the nation isn't going to sit back and let the community be torn apart by illicit and prescription drug abuse. The lawsuit points to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data that indicates Native children 12 and older use opioids for non-medical purposes at a rate double that of white children. Begay says Native Americans have disproportionately suffered during health crises for generations, and the opioid addiction epidemic is no different. Tribes in the Dakotas, Wyoming, and Wisconsin have recently filed similar lawsuits. Minnesota lawmakers are considering creating a task force to address the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the state. The St. Paul Pioneer Press reported a House committee heard testimony Wednesday on the bill, which has broad bipartisan support. The Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women says while Native American women make up just 1% of the state's population, at least 9% of victims of domestic violence-related homicides are Native. The task force, with representatives from tribal governments and law enforcement agencies, would report annually to the Minnesota legislature. It would study systemic causes of violence against Native women and girls, how to better track and collect data, and how to resolve jurisdictional barriers. If the legislation is passed, the task force could start as soon as October. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
Reuters reports that German police have detained four men, one who they expect of planning knife attacks at last Sunday's Berlin Half Marathon. The story was initially reported in the German newspaper Die Welt in its online edition. Die Welt said the four suspects were linked to Anis Amri, who is of Tunisian descent. Amri was discovered to have Islamist militant ties, who were responsible for the killing of 12 people in an attack in Berlin in December 2016, when he hijacked a truck and drove it into a crowded marketplace. Berlin police were not immediately available for comment.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, announced that the country will no longer be participating in exploratory offshore drilling sites and will not be renewing permits, although it will honor all existing permits. This comes as the small nation aims to become carbon neutral by 2050. There have been harsh responses from those within the oil industry, claiming that it's irresponsible and thousands of jobs could be lost.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. By the way, it's our birthday soon. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs turns 46 on May 2nd. Has KBOO News made a positive impact on your life? Do you have a story to tell? Call us at 503-231-8032, extension 203, and we may broadcast your message. You can also call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenka Soderberg and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Zello Celis Marchand. Our engineer is Ben Shireki. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zello Celis Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, the beloved community looks at the rising threats to free speech, Muslim-Christian dialogue, and LGBTQ advocacy. At 10, Valley Views talks to the program manager at Edible Corvallis Initiative at the Corvallis Environmental Center. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, the Digital Divide talks about Facebook testimony in front of Congress, internet privacy, and our personal accountability. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Ethos Music Center is launching a new website to celebrate 20 years of teaching and making music. The celebration continues with the center's annual Ovation Gala, May 2nd, at the downtown Portland Hilton. The site, ethosat20.org, culls from Ethos' extensive photo and video archives, highlighting the homegrown origins of the organization and its development into one of the largest music education nonprofits in the state. The year's annual Ovation Gala will also be a celebration of Ethos' 20th anniversary, with student performances and memories of the last two decades. Tickets are available on the Ovation website at https://ethos.ejoinme.org/ovation. Photos featured at ethosat20.org shows origins of the organization with an emphasis on African drumming and drum making, individual and group lessons, student performances, music assemblies, hip-hop production, and notably the famed Music Mobile, a repurposed bright red double-decker bus that was being used to bring performances and an instrument petting zoo to communities around the state. We have in the studio Executive Director Scott Moore. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Scott, welcome to KBOO's Rhythm Central.
Well, thank you.
Who are you? What are you doing at Ethos Music? What's going on there?
Yep, I'm Scott Moore. I'm the executive director. What we do at Ethos Music Center is we provide music education to kids throughout Portland and across the state of Oregon. We are celebrating our 20th anniversary year this year, which feels really, really amazing. We were started in 1998 by Charles Lewis and a band of dedicated volunteers who... This all happened right around when deep budget cuts started happening in our local schools. And as you probably well know, arts and music programs are usually the first on the chopping block. So what we had was a situation where kids, especially in low-income areas, an entire generation of kids were being robbed of music and arts education and enrichment. So Charles and the volunteer founders of Ethos set out to create an organization that would fill that gap and ensure that that students could still have access to music education.
Scott, you didn't say who you are.
I'm Scott Moore. I've been the executive director since this last October. Previously, I served on the board of directors at Ethos Music Center. I was the board chair for a couple of years. I've been involved for about a decade. It's very close to my heart. I am a guitar player.
You're a guitar player?
Yeah, I play guitar, play bass. Yeah, yeah.
You play in a band?
I do play in a band, yeah.
What's your band?
Our band is, we're called Heavy City. We've actually played in this very room in the past. We've played KBOO a couple times.
Okay,
yeah,
back to
that's great.
Back to Ethos, sorry.
Could you tell us about some of the classes you all offer over there?
Yeah, so I'll tell you a little bit about the programs that we run. So we have our headquarters is and has been since 2005 at the corner of Williams and Killingsworth in North Portland. It's a very central location. We feel like it's a very important anchor in the community. We do in-house group and individual lessons there on a sliding scale. So students who, if they're in school, if they qualify for free reduced lunch, they have a reduced tuition rate. The idea is that we can, you know, we make sure that music education is available for all kids. We have instruments are all, just about every instrument that we've got through the in the building, and there's a lot of them, are donated by members of the community, and that enables us to rent out at a very, very low cost instruments to kids. So there's no barrier there. The lessons are affordable. The instruments are very affordable. So we give them all the tools that they need in order to follow their musical dreams. We also run after-school programs in 13 low-income schools throughout Portland in conjunction with the Sun School programs and other community organizations. And we run a very innovative rural outreach program, which is a partnership with the Federal AmeriCorps program, where we put 10 full-time music instructors in rural, low-income communities around the state. And they're there all year long. They do in-school programming, so they basically build up music programs for communities that otherwise couldn't afford them at all. And then they even do after-school programming and individual lessons for kids at no cost. And so it's a unique program, but it's very, very effective and very impactful.
That's amazing. I was just thinking about my school experiences and mm-hmm. getting exposed to like Langston Hughes and stuff like that, and how that just opened up a path of exploration for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Like, and so if you think about, you know, children not having those opportunities mm-hmm. in the normal, you know, unfortunately, in the normal public school system, because of so many, you know, two decades now of budget cuts, mm-hmm. we exist to try and fill that gap as best we can. We'll never be a full replacement for, you know, publicly funded in-school instruction, but mm-hmm. but we are really providing enrichment that kids otherwise wouldn't get.
Do you get most of your funding from the school districts?
We get it's a broad mix of funding. We get money from lessons when people come in and take lessons. We get the AmeriCorps program is partially funded by the AmeriCorps program, so that's a federal grant. We get funding through the Portland Children's Levy, which is, by the way, up for renewal in May. At the ballot, so that's a very important thing people should pay attention to. It's a very important
Wait,
program.
What's the Children's Levy?
The Portland Children's Levy is it's a publicly funded fund to support programming that benefits low-income, at-risk youth.
To levy on the retail sales tax?
It is. No, it's a property. It's property tax based.
Property tax.
And it's been in existence for close to two decades now in Portland in a couple of different forms. And it gets renewed every few years.
Okay, I interrupted you.
No, it is important, though, because they are an important partner in Ethos. We're able to do the kinds of things we're doing because of that commitment from the city. We also get funding through foundations and grants, but we also get a lot of funding through individual donors, people who give gifts large and small. Who believe in the mission of Ethos and believe that kids should have access to music education.
Is it only kids or can I go?
You can absolutely go. Most of our students are kids, but we do definitely have adults who come in and take lessons because our instructors are world class. They are among the best in the city. So we're a great place for any people of all ages to come in and learn an instrument or get better. I'm actually thinking about starting voice lessons very soon for myself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I guess I was going to ask, do you have to be a musician to get involved, but you can actually have intentions of becoming a musician to get involved?
Absolutely. Yeah. You could start at all levels. You know, for kids, we'll start them out in group lessons. Sometimes it can be a less intimidating way to really get started. We have Kinder Keys classes, we have choir, we have group ukulele classes, which are really adorable and a lot of fun. And then once they get some basic skills, they can graduate to one-on-one lessons and really start honing their skills. We also can teach adults, you know, at any skill level. If anybody wants to help out, though, you don't have to be musically inclined. We have a lot of volunteers who profess to have no musical ability whatsoever. We'll take help from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Can we come down and just visit and see the facility?
Absolutely. We're open Monday through Friday. We open at noon. We're open until 8 o'clock. Saturdays we're open 10 to 2. We would love to have you by, do a tour. We're very, very proud of our facility. We do a lot in that space. We have 14 classrooms where we do lessons. We have a beautiful recital hall where we can do band rehearsals, recitals, community concerts, beautiful lobby space. It's a one of a kind building. We're really thrilled, and I think people tend to fall in love with Ethos when they come by and see us.
And you have a fancy schmancy gala coming up.
We do. It's our
Ovation Gala. Tell us about that.
Yep. This is we started this a few years ago. It is now our biggest single fundraising event. And it is, for the first year, it's at the Hilton. It has been at the Sentinel Hotel in previous years. It really is, you know, when you say it's a gala, it sounds very fancy, and it is. It's a lovely evening. There's, you know, great food. We have wine sponsors that are wonderful. Winderly, DuPont Cellars, R. Stewart are very generous. But it's really all centered around our student performances. The students put their all into the performances. They're inspiring. They're moving. You can't attend and not come away moved.
It's not about wearing a tuxedo, right?
Oh no.
It's not that kind of gala.
No, absolutely not. Although we wouldn't turn somebody away if they were wearing a tuxedo, of course. But it's about community building. It's about supporting Ethos. It's about giving kids a platform to perform, to express themselves. Really, Ethos really is about making sure that all kids have a home. They've got a place where they can come and be themselves and express themselves.
And you guys are celebrating a 20th anniversary. What do you expect the next 20 years to look like? What do you want out of that?
Yeah, I think to continue expanding our reach, but staying true to our mission. Which is very, very clearly ensuring that all kids have access to music education, regardless of socioeconomic status or geographic location or any other barrier that could keep them from the life-changing power of music education. And as we know, the need isn't going anywhere, unfortunately. The need for Ethos will be there for 20 years and beyond.
Are you only taking students from Oregon, or can they come from Washington?
They could come in from, if they wanted to come over from Vancouver, they certainly could. We don't, at present, we don't have a reach up there, so we're not in any Vancouver schools or any Southwest Washington schools. Something that we might consider moving forward, but there's lots of places in Portland where I think we need to get to first.
Great. We just got one more minute left, and we'd like to give you a chance to just reiterate the gala,
yeah, sure,
and how to help out at
absolutely
Ethos.
So you can go an easier URL. You can just go to ethos.org, and if you go there, you'll see a banner that says "Join us for the Ovation Gala." You can click on that. It'll take you. If you're a local business owner and you want to find out how to become a sponsor, there's information there. If you wanted to come and attend, if you want to volunteer, there's opportunities there too. We would love to have you at the event. It's really a special night.
Great. Thank you so much. That was Scott Moore. Unless you had something else you wanted to add, Tom.
No, terrific. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
We look forward to seeing the facility and hopefully getting to the gala.
That sounds great.
That sounds great.
The time is 5:58 and 55 seconds. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is the one, the only, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KBOO's history.
KBOO, I really think, is a good resource, and they give a voice to people who might be isolated or disfranchised. I thought that was good how they put it in the mission statement.
KBOO was a lot of activity, and I was struck by the diversity. It was very welcoming, and I thought, this is something I like to be involved with.
The day I walked in, it was during pledge drive, and I was immediately pulled over to the membership drive table, which was in the front lobby, and we were all talking on the air about why you should join KBOO. And it was fun.
To hear the stories of people who helped make KBOO what it is today, go to 50yearsofkboo.fm and click on KBOO Stories Project.
Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this great station, and you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KBOO Board of Directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16th. 2018. We need folks who love KBOO and are committed to our community values. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO.
You are